T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Now, with the MLB app, you can get baseball your way. Pick your favorite team, your favorite players, and get customized highlights, stories, and breaking news right on your home feed. Follow the action with Game Day, where 3D replays add another dimension. Plus, notifications can keep you connected to every pitch, every hit, every game. The MLB app. Baseball, your way. Download it now for free from the App Store or Google Play. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Thank you, Dave. It is 9:10, and we're going to spend an hour talking about addiction and the neuroscience of addiction and how it works in your brains and brain and the differences with different drugs, opiates, marijuana, THC, alcohol, cocaine. And the person we're going to spend the time with is Judy Grizzell, a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Bucknell University and a former addict herself. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm well, thanks.
I appreciate you taking the time with us, author of Never Enough. I had the title of the book right here, and then it went away. Professor, tell me the name of the book.
It's Never Enough, The Neuroscience and Experience of Addiction. And just like you said, I describe what's going on in the brain, and then I connect that to the experience of people who are suffering with addictive disorders.
And let me say myself, I've never been diagnosed or anything or gone to a meeting, but I knew that I had a problem with alcohol and that I had to get away from it because I'm just can't. I'm not wired up in a way where I can have a drink or two. It's like, if we're going to drink, well, by gosh, let's drink. And I realize that's not the best thing for me. That being said,
I was the same.
Pardon me?
Yeah, I was exactly the same. The first time I took a drink, I was about 13, and I thought it was the solution to all my problems. It really did much more for me than it does for people, let's say, who are different than you and I. And I was interested in what's different about my brain and maybe your brain that make that response so powerful.
And that's why I wanted to have you on for an hour, because this whole thing fascinates me, the neuroscience of it. We know we drink and we get... they're happy drunks, they're mean drunks, right? Then we know that people get high on marijuana, we take opioids, or some people take opioids and they get addicted to them. But I want to know what's going on actually in the brain and the differences with these drugs, and it's exactly, I believe, what your book addresses. Let's start with alcohol. It is a common thing here in the area. I know the French do it. They give their kids a taste of alcohol. Here in New Orleans, we have crawfish boils and things like that, and we give our kids a taste of beer at an early age. I think I was maybe about your age, 12 or 13, not your age now, Professor, but 12 or 13 when I had my first sip of beer, and maybe 15 or 14 when I got drunk for the first time. Talk about the differences, if you will, of what happens in your brain and you consume alcohol when you're young as opposed to, say, 20 or 25, or when your brain is fully formed. This is your field, so I'm just going to open the floor and sit back and listen.
Sure. So every drug that's addictive works on a shared part of the brain having to do with the circuit that tells us what's meaningful or really important or noteworthy. So one reason we like alcohol and cocaine and opiates and all of those is because they kind of light up our brains the same way that, say, sexual foreplay or, tasty food when you're hungry does. So it's a kind of a cue. And then each drug has its own separate kinds of actions that are responsible for, say, alcohol being a sedative and opiates reducing pain and cocaine making you more aroused and alert. But you kind of hit the nail on the head when you described asked about the difference between early use, like we had, and later use. The head of the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism has said that there's, he says there's two ways to become addicted. One is to be born that way, kind of with enough predisposition. And we know that half of the predisposition is what we're born with. So some people have just the cards stacked against them, or to drink a lot. But I would say there's a third way, and that is to drink a moderate amount when you're young. And so the just in the same way that kids learn everything better than adults do, mm-hmm. addiction is a form of learning where the brain adapts to the drug. And so it's going to begin adapting as soon as you start. And the better you are at learning or adapting, the quicker it'll induce the changes that are responsible for what we call addiction or alcoholism. And those are mostly things like tolerance, where you need more to feel the same good effect, dependence, where you kind of feel not good without it after a while, after your brain is really used to it. And those things set up craving, where you spend a lot of time thinking about it and you give up other activities that don't involve it. So just one statistic that relates to what you're asking is that if you begin drinking before you're 18 and get drunk, so not just a sip, but the sip is the first thing, I guess. So if you get drunk before you're 18, your chances of developing alcoholism, or what we now call alcohol use disorder, are about 1 in 4.
Wow.
If you wait until you're 21, when your brain is not quite fully developed, but, you know, the legal age, your chances are about 1 in 25. Mm-hmm. So it's a very steep change. As the brain is being formed in adolescence, like before you're 18, especially, it's really setting up the highways. And those highways, when they're bathed in alcohol, are formed in a way that makes you kind of innately respond differently.
So these are not, first of all, is there a difference between 21 and, say, 25 years old, Professor?
Yes, there is. There is. There's more difference between 21 and 25 than 25 and 29. So we think about 25, maybe, a little later for males. Their brains are slower to develop slightly, and maybe a little earlier for women. But somewhere around there, it's kind of reached its adult mature state. And what that is that the highways, so in between puberty and, say, 21 at least, but maybe 25 at most, you're forming your identity. Mm-hmm. You know, you're figuring out who you are. You're not the same as your parents. You like these things and not those things. You're deciding, you know, and this is sort of the developmental milestone of adolescence. Who am I and what do I care about? What do I want to do with my life? So that, what that looks like in the brain is that the structures that form a stable sense of self are being kind of not quite solidified or concretized, but at least mainly formed. Things change. We can always change. We can change on our deathbed at 100, but it's a lot harder to do. Whereas, you know, during this kind of sweet time between puberty and 25, the changes are just waiting to happen. The brain is wide open to those kinds of changes. And so it's responsive to all kinds of experiences, including good things like falling in love or becoming an artist or, figuring out who and what you are, but also not such good things like the experience of drugs.
And
when
drugs
get on that, oh, go ahead.
No. I'm here to listen to you. I'm sorry. I thought you had paused.
I'm sorry. I could go on for 2 hours. But when drugs get on that very plastic brain or that kind of wide open brain, then they lay the pathways down in a different way than if they're not. And we have great evidence, for instance, in longitudinal studies. So you take kids before they start drinking and then follow them as they either do or don't drink, and you keep track of how much, that the way the pathways are built are substantially different. And that's not the case if you start drinking at 25 or 26.
And
I
want to bring the audience in here at 504-260-1870 if they have any questions or comments as we proceed through this hour. these things are not mutually exclusive. And you mentioned predisposition, which I guess would be a genetic thing, Professor?
Yes, genetic or epigenetic. So it's something you're born with and it's in your genome, either in the sequence of the genes themselves, or we now realize that changes have been made to the genome. And some of those changes, interestingly enough, probably come from our parents and maybe our grandparents' drinking patterns. So we come in with a liability.
Wait, really? So
yeah. Yes.
You can actually change the predisposition that the people who come after you, your progeny, will have if you develop a drinking problem? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, drinking or other drugs. And this is better studied right now because it's kind of a new take on the heritability or the innate predisposition that we're talking about. So for instance, people have known for probably hundreds of years that substance use disorders run in families. You know, there's certain families that really go at it and others don't. And one reason for that, we've realized it's genetic because if the children of, you know, the offspring are adopted to teetotalers, let's say, they still have that predisposition. So what are you inheriting? Well, for a long time, we thought it was the genes, which is the sequence of the DNA that codes for our proteins. But we've had the human genome cloned or sequenced for almost a quarter of a century now, and we haven't really made much headway on that. On the other hand, in animal studies where it's easy to do these kinds of experiments, especially adolescent exposure to, say, alcohol at pretty high doses or to THC or other drugs. And then you take those drugs away, the rats or the mice grow up. They then get married, I guess, and have their offspring and then their grandchildren eventually. And all of those are at increased risk.
Wow.
And in those studies, we can locate the changes to the genome, and those are modifications to the structure but not the sequence. I know that's kind of confusing. I could talk about it more, but basically the genome responds differently to the environment. But there are genes that confer risk too, and one of them maybe you and I had, or one of them that I think is interesting, for instance, and maybe is a good illustration of this, is there's been studies that show that people who have a lot of alcoholics in their family but haven't yet had a drink, so young kids, have low levels of endorphin in their blood. So they inherit kind of a deficiency of endorphin, which is kind of like our natural version of morphine or heroin. Mm-hmm. So they're walking around maybe with about half as much as normal. And yet when they drink alcohol, they get this massive rise in endorphin levels. So it not only kind of self-medicates their deficiency, but then some. Whereas if you have no alcoholics in your family, you have higher levels of endorphin to begin with, and your system isn't very responsive to alcohol. So if you give alcohol to those two sets of people, one of them is going to find it much more pleasurable than the others, who might say, yeah, that's fine, you know, I'll probably drink again someday. So I think that there is a very complex set of genetic and epigenetic factors that tip the scales so that people respond differently from the beginning. And that really makes the point that it's not, you know, just a matter of being, you know, determined or having good fortitude or something. You really do respond differently from the very outset.
I remember when my, we got to take a break here. We'll pick it up. We come back. I remember when my grown child now, went off to college, and after our surgery got pain medication, I gave the warning, you got the genes, so be very careful with this stuff when it comes to drinking and when it comes to pain medication. And I had no idea to the extent that the professor just told us, but I think it was good advice, and it's not mutually exclusive. So if you have an increased chance, if you drink and get drunk before 18, you have a 1 in 4 chance of having a problem. That is in addition to the genetic predisposition and over-drinking. So we'll talk about that more when we come back. Dr. Judy Grizel, our guest professor of psychology and neuroscience at Bucknell University. We're talking about the chemistry of drug addiction and what happens. We'll talk about different drugs and more when we come back. Certainly your questions are open. The Oakland Art Jeweler Talk and Text Line at 504-260-1870. Fascinating stuff, man. I'm going to tell you what. We'll pick it up when we come back on WWL.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Now, we're talking to Dr. Judy Grizel, professor of psychology neuroscience at Bucknell University. If you missed any of this, you can go to WWL.com, click on audio, then Tommy Tucker, and you can listen to the interview, or you can always download the Odyssey app and use the rewind feature, because there's some pretty interesting stuff she's telling us. And, doctor, we're not going to get it all in 1 hour, so I reserve the right to call you back. Professor of psychology, neuroscience at Bucknell, a former addict herself, and we're talking about the neuroscience, the chemical reaction of the brain. Let me get to some of the questions if I can. Tommy, please ask about children who take ADHD medicine and then as young teenagers have to take antidepressants. Are they more likely to drink, or what effect does that have on the brain's pathways?
Great question. The ADHD medicine is a version of amphetamine, and amphetamine is certainly addictive, especially in the form of methamphetamine, but it's kind of the same general compound with slightly different kinetics. So people wonder, is that itself addictive? Mm-hmm. However, ADHD itself is a risk factor for addiction. So being untreated makes it more likely that you'll develop problems with drugs, including THC, and alcohol and other drugs. So it needs to be treated, and the drugs themselves are considered safe if they're used as directed. So, you know, taking breaks, not taking more than you need, you know, if you have a paper due, don't, you know, overdo it. So actually getting treated for ADHD helps protect against people kind of self-medicating themselves and then being higher at risk. I hope that helps.
Yeah, it does. But with that being said, it is imperative, I would think, I'm inferring, that the diagnosis be dead on accurate about ADHD, because if not, and you're prescribing these medications to somebody that is not ADHD, then you are creating an addict and developing pathways that shouldn't be there?
Well, it's really about the amount of drug that's on the brain, but the problem is you can't diagnose behavioral disorders, really, things like ADHD or depression or anxiety, in the same way you can diagnose things like cancer or diabetes, you know, with a blood test or looking at the cells. It's kind of subjective. Yeah. So some people, it's kind of like obesity, I think. You know, some people we could say clearly they fall on the pathological side, and some people clearly not. But the middle ground is a little bit squiffy. So one thing to know is that if you might be in the middle ground, it's always safer, I think, to start with behavioral changes, maybe therapy or other kinds of non-medicine treatments. But for some people, the medicine is necessary and kind of extremely helpful.
Somebody else texted in about introducing kids to alcohol. I know in France they make it part of the family meal, and they have a different approach. Europeans look at it differently. What is I don't know what studies show in France, but is it all about drinking to excess, or how should a parent introduce their child to alcohol?
So it's kind of funny because the French people say, you know, to be an alcoholic, you drink like an American, which means to binge drink, mm-hmm. you know, go overboard. And the Americans sometimes used to say, oh, to be a real alcoholic, you need to drink every day like the French. There's plenty of alcoholism in France and in Germany and in the U.S. So it is so, and everywhere else in the world, it's really prevalent. 3 million people die every year around the world from too much alcohol. It's a massive problem. But it's interesting. If you drink very slowly and very little, it won't even reach your brain. It will be metabolized by the liver, especially if you're having it with a meal. And let's say you're having what a kid might have, a half a glass of wine with a meal, and you're sipping it very slowly. You won't even feel the effects. If you don't feel the effects, then the brain's not changing, probably. It's really not. The liver will change. Now, I'm not a proponent of that because I don't think that actually works. But I think for some people might feel like, you know, if it's this big taboo subject, the first time they get a chance to drink, they might overdo it. I don't know. I don't think there's strong evidence that giving it or not giving it to young people matters as much as how much they drink and when they drink it. So, you know, if you're sometimes you meet people who are very relaxed about drugs themselves and they think, oh, you know, just let my kids try it too. I think that's usually not a good thing.
So what you're talking about is drinking for the taste as opposed to drinking for the effect, right? If you're going to drink it slowly, like a nice wine, if you like the flavor of wine, and you're drinking it not as mommy's calm down juice, and I'm not calling out moms specifically, I'm just using that as a catch-all, but that's the difference. If you're drinking it just because you savor the flavor of the wine and you drink it slowly enough so your liver metabolizes it and it never gets to your brain, that's completely different than drinking it for the effect. And to be clear, people drink alcohol, I would think, in most cases because of the effect on the brain, yes?
Well, yes, probably. And really, it's not that good of a taste. You have to sort of acquire it. So there's probably no 14-year-olds that are thinking, geez, if I just had a little wine to go with my fish here, it would be a better meal. I think I think the idea in those cases is to say that if they're used to drinking it slowly and a little bit and not feeling it, then when they're out with their friends and they're 18, they're not going to have this, you know, like the horse out of the gate sort of feeling mm-hmm. to hurry up and overdo it. I don't know that that really works. As I said, there's plenty of alcoholism. Many people are, you know, dying in France as they're dying in the U.S. So it's an interesting drug because we have a mixed relationship with it. We think it's, you know, this thing that enhances food, that's good for you, that maybe even benefits your life, but health-wise, it's a toxin. And even little bits of alcohol reduce your life expectancy. So the new thinking based on hundreds of thousands of subjects around the world is that the safe amount of alcohol, if you want to live your longest and healthiest life, is zero.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up here when we come back because to me, doctor, and it all comes down to, and, you know, I think I might have told you this before, and a lot of people that have had problems, addicts, I'll say the word, have said it. It's kind of like, and I know there's a difference when it comes to marijuana and alcohol, and we're not going to have time this hour to do it, but we'll get into it next time. But the difference is living the world in black and white or living it in color. And a lot of times we drink alcohol or we take other drugs because it takes that black and white TV in our brain, or maybe it's just the way we're wired up, and turns it into color. And the problem is, once you get used to watching color TV, it's hard to go back to black and white on a daily basis unless maybe it's the way our brains are wired up, where you don't necessarily always see it like color, black and white. We'll delve into that when we return with Judy Grizzell, professor of psychology, neuroscience at Bucknell University. We're talking about alcohol and drugs and other drugs, I should say, and how it affects your brain, the chemistry in your brain, the neuroscience involved. 939, 21 till 10, traffic now, WWL. 10:46, 14 till 10. Tommy Tucker, an interesting conversation with Dr. Judy Grizzell, professor of psychology and neuroscience at Bucknell University. Her book is Never Enough, The Neuroscience and Experience of Addiction, and you can get it at Amazon and I guess all the usual the usual outlets.
I'm sure, yes.
I think I must be hungry. That's why I said omelets. When it comes to acquired taste, maybe that's what I'm thinking of as well. You talked about learning to drink alcohol, because any kid would probably rather a soft drink than wine with their dinner, as far as getting them accustomed to it. And I just got to thinking that the first reaction your body has if you're not used to drinking, or maybe if you are, when you drink hard liquor is you want to regurgitate it, right? You have a tendency that it's going to come right back up. Same thing with smoking. You have to teach yourself to smoke, which is a very unpleasant experience to begin with, but people do it because of the benefits. And I guess I'm wondering, as it relates to people that are born with the predisposition, the 1 in 4, I think you said they have if they have that genetic predisposition, as if they drink as a child, they have a 1 in 4 chance of becoming an alcoholic. Do they have more of a propensity to get themselves past that point of revulsion to, I'm going to chug through this, pardon the pun, to see that I get to the feeling good aspect of it and changing the brain feeling part of it?
Yeah, so it's a good question. It's such a complicated thing to kind of solve. There's not, as I thought there might be when I first started studying this, you know, one or two main factors that kind of light the match and that's the cause. It's much more complicated. So, for example, if your mother drinks when you're young, even probably casually, and then you're used to smelling it on her breath, when you later smell alcohol, especially if your mother was loving and kind, you might have warm feelings about that smell because it gets associated with, you know, the comfort of a mother. But the kids who are likely to take the drugs to begin with at 13 or 14 or 15, like we did, those are ones that tend to be high in novelty seeking. So they like to try new things. They like to take risks. They don't really care about punishment so much. So even though they've heard, you know, don't do drugs, they think, what's it going to do to me? And they're really interested in kind of going out on a limb. So those kids, when they hear the messages, they're going to ignore them. So the taste is not so much the driver, obviously. It's to see, what is all this about? Mm-hmm. You know, what is it going to be? Most people who pick up a vape pen or nicotine in some other form today, usually it's vaping, they do it only just to see what it's like. They're just curious. And some of us are more likely to make risky, curious choices than others who may be more sensible to begin with. So that is part of our innate predisposition. So it's not that you so much like the taste more as you are especially curious about this new experience.
Well, I mentioned before we went to break the black and white and color, which I think is an accurate analogy. A lot of addicts have made that distinction before about when, you know, when you're high or drunk or whatever, you see the world in color and it's a nice place. But when you're straight, you see it in black and white, and it's like, wow, this is not great. So how does anybody alter their brain chemistry, which is what alcohol and other drugs do? How do they alter their brain chemistry responsibly and not get addicted to seeing the world in color or black and white? Or is it not that way when everybody uses alcohol and other drugs?
No, it is that way. I think, I was listening to the crawfish contest, mm-hmm. which is making my mouth water just a few minutes ago. And I was thinking, well, compare that with, a bowl of plain oatmeal or something. Mm-hmm. So we're going to kind of find that it tasty and intriguing and pleasant in a way that's natural, but also really good. So we kind of tend to seek out things that are in color. And for that reason, we've, you know, been to the moon and made the Hubble telescope and having crawfish cook-offs. And so I think that that appetitive or that nature of ours to push for technicolor over bland is good. The dilemma comes because drugs, which are good at leveraging that technicolor, they do it pretty directly. They're so available. So we've been using drugs since before humans were humans. I mean, that's perennial, the beginning of time. But we haven't had the kind of access that we do today to all kinds of high potency things, pretty much on demand. And so what we can do is we can cause the color when and where we want. The problem, though, is that it's kind of like bleaching out your eyeballs. You know, the more you see the color, the less sensitive you become to it. Mm. So now the world is completely bland without it. And
it's like you keep hitting vivid on the TV, right, on the setting. It's
you
like,
have
not bright
to,
enough, not bright enough.
Otherwise, it's too bleak. Exactly. Mm. It's too bleak. And the point we were making earlier in the show is that some people are born with less sensitivity to begin with to the color. And those people are more prone because they're not already stimulated enough, and the drugs really do it. So there's a different risk, but anybody will enjoy pretty much that technicolor. And if it's not from alcohol, it'll be from THC or it'll be from cocaine. So they're going to enjoy those feelings, and then they're going to overuse. And the more you overuse, just like we said, the less sensitive you get. And so now, just to feel normal or to drag yourself out of bed, you got to have a little nip. And then you're, you know, having a disorder.
So can alcohol be used responsibly?
Sure, can. By some people, better than others. Most people who drink don't develop an alcohol use disorder, which means, to me, the best definition of an addiction is where the costs of reusing outweigh the benefits. There's always costs. As I said, even a little bit of alcohol does damage your health in ways we can measure. But on the other hand, so does chocolate cake and probably too much crawfish. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's worth it because life is short and, you know, it's okay. Some people, though, the costs outweigh the benefits. You know, they lose their homes, they lose their jobs, they lose their marriages. So for those people, it's irrational. And that, I would say, is when you have a problem. So can some people do it? Yes. And lots of ways to encourage that. The biggest way is to not start until you're 25, which is hard to do because most people are likely to experiment when they're young. Yeah. Another way is to know your family history and have an idea of your risk. Another way is to not develop habits. You know, if occasional use is much less likely to cause a problem than regular and high use, obviously, because the adaptation by the brain is much slower. But the big message, I think, is that any of us, like you and me, can change our brain to go back the other way, where we now see things in color without the drug. So it's all about the brain adapting, and it's gonna respond to what we give it.
I can't thank you enough for your time. I can't wait to have you back on because we could talk about this for 20 hours and still not be done.
That would be great.
Dr. Judy Grizzell, Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at Bucknell University, trying to help us understand what happens with drugs and alcohol in our brains. We'll take a break, figure out what Noel Norman's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.